Hey, this is Ryan Dawson of the ANC Report, the Anti-Neocon Report. With me today is Ava Bartlett, a real journalist. She's lived in Palestine for a number of years. She's been to Syria multiple times, had to self-fund those trips, which if you're in alt media, you know how expensive and what a task that can be. She's been taking the mass media to school. She recently blew up on YouTube, but not for the first time, and she's also been reporting for RT and several news outlets, someone on the ground, and we're going to go over the propaganda that we're hearing about Syria, in particular Aleppo, which the mass media, corporate media, wants to act like is another Holocaust. And France right now has the Eiffel Tower set to dark in solidarity with the victims of Aleppo, even though they wouldn't even do that when France was attacked. So, Ava, I've been waiting to talk to you a long time. I'm following you for a while, whether you know or not, and it's really good to have you on.
Thanks very much, Ryan. I think I was mentioning to you that I've been following your work for a while, so it's nice to connect with you.
You know, that's something. I was recently in Australia, and I met a lot of people who I've been reading or watching for a long time, and it starts to see the world get a little smaller. I was on Press TV yesterday, and Tim Anderson was on right before me, and I was thinking I was just at his house a few days ago. And so it's good to talk to you, and I see in your most recent blog entry mentioning people who I just met recently. So I'm glad that we're getting together, and I'm seeing a real alt media, not the crazy Jonestown kind, but a real alt media forming. And no, we're not all Russian hackers. I want to talk to you about the corporate media because it's been as bad on Syria as it was in the build-up to the Iraq war, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. Yeah, and you know, on that note, I'm just surprised that the people who believe the corporate media, I'm surprised they've forgotten, you know, what happened with the lead-up to the war on Iraq and Libya.
That's true, although I think a lot of them were just partisan. A lot of people on the left were against the war in Iraq just because they hated George Bush. It really wasn't about justice or any kind of real empathy for people in Iraq. That was just a theme for them to exercise their hatred of Republicans. And so now that we have a Democrat as the president, then suddenly all these wars are for humanitarian reasons and they fall for every thin pretext. And when something gets debunked, it doesn't matter. They just move along to the next lie. The chemical weapons or gas attack would be this theme's weapons of mass destruction, literally. And the rebels were busted with that on several occasions. And then suddenly, oh yes, Assad's going to use sarin gas on the day that the UN is there to inspect chemical weapons in the location where they're inspecting chemical weapons.
Yeah, I mean it's preposterous, and with all the other lies and vilifications of both Assad and Russia, you know, if just logically, if Syria knows, you know, essentially the whole world is against it, why would they use chemical weapons at that critical juncture in time, you know, and why would they do the things the corporate media is alleging they're doing in Aleppo, which are actually not happening, if they know that this means that potentially the world could get, you know, angry and impose a no-fly zone on them.
Yeah, and on Russia as well. Yes, there's no motive, and there was no forensic evidence either. I mean, gas was used, but there was no evidence to where it came from. But that really didn't matter. They had the conclusions made already prior to investigating at all. And that made Syria lose its deterrent. Its chemical weapons was a deterrent. You know, their neighbors have nuclear weapons, like the Israelis, which have acted as al-Qaeda's air force. And so once that was gone, you saw the U.S. move in the air. And they're always accidentally aiding ISIS and accidentally bombing the Syrian army during ceasefire.
Yeah.
I want to ask you about this Aleppo, the last fill in the blank in Aleppo. Recently we had this, the mass media was calling it death bulletins, which turned out to be just four or five activists that they used over and over. But, I mean, you've been to Syria. You've talked to people on the ground. You speak Arabic. You know what the locals are saying. Give us the alternative. What's really happening in Syria?
So, in early 2011, the way the corporate media reported it was that there were a series of nonviolent demonstrations originating in a border town named Dara, which incidentally borders Israel, Syria's enemy. And the claims went that first, that a number of children were abused, and I will address some of these points, that a number of children were abused by security force, and then that because of this and because of general unrest, you know, protests kicked off in Dara. The claims go, again, purported by Al Jazeera, of course, of all reputable sources, that the security forces were very heavy-handed and were massacring unarmed, nonviolent protesters, and that protests, you know, caught fire across the country and throughout the country, according to this narrative, security forces were attacking protesters. But in fact, the realities, you know, that we've learned with hindsight and with enough time, we're not in 2011 or 2012 now, were that yes, there were apparently a group of children who wrote graffiti on a wall, and yes, they were taken into custody and perhaps not treated well by whatever local security force. He was then, it might have been the head of security in Dara, he was then fired, and the president sent people either from the ministry or high up people in the Syrian government to Dara to issue official apologies to the families of these boys who were not killed, but they might have been roughed up. And the families, according to people I know that have interviewed folks in Dara, the families accepted. And before these officials from the Syrian government got back to Damascus that day, Dara was on fire. Other things that I've learned in investigations and in others' investigative reports were that the protests in Dara were not unarmed and were not nonviolent. And later it was discovered that there was a weapons storage in the Al-Omari Mosque in Dara. So now, just pausing here, you know, if we think that these were spontaneous protests, unarmed, why the heck was there a storage of weapons in this mosque in Dara?
I want to add to that, too, because I can corroborate what you're saying there, because I interviewed Virginia Senator Richard Black, whose interpreter was at the protests in Dara, and mm-hmm. he said, you know, what they were originally doing about police abuse, something you would common in the United States, because that story blew up so much because of outfits like Al Jazeera. A little history of Al Jazeera for the listeners. Al Jazeera is Qatar's state-run media. Qatar backs the Muslim Brotherhood, which fought with Assad's father for over a decade. The Muslim Brotherhood also is who allegedly attacked the World Trade Center in 1993. So they are officially a terrorist organization, and yet you know, these people are controlling the narrative on the origins of the Syrian conflict. Now, Richard Black's interpreter said that they had very briefly peaceful protests, which were then, you know, overtaken by these groups, foreigners who had the Al-Qaeda flags. And they said, get rid of those. We don't want those. And then they had fully automatic weapons. Now, Syria doesn't have the right to bear arms, so where were they getting these guns out of the blue? And of course, you're saying there was a weapons cache in the mosque.
Yeah, and so now to add to that corroboration, when I was in Syria this summer, I interviewed a soldier. Now, he was based in Damascus, but at some point after the first week of protest in Dara, he and roughly 300 soldiers were sent to Dara, and they were sent to be present at these protests to keep the peace. And notable is that they were sent, according to him, and I have no reason to disbelieve him, they were sent without weapons except for batons. And he said that en route, in the middle of the night, before they reached Dara, their bus was attacked. Basically, there was something laid on the road which punctured the tires of the bus. When they got down from the bus to fix the tires, they were attacked with by people they could not see with Molotov cocktails. In any case, they managed to fix the tires, move on, get to Dara, and as he recorded or reported, you know, the first Friday that they were present, all with only batons, no weapons, including their commanders. He said when the protesters came, amongst the protesters, there were people who had weapons and that were firing upon them and killed 28 police officers and one soldier, and that they were running for their lives, these soldiers and the 500 police officers, and they were chased by mobs who were, you know, continued to try to fire at them, throwing Molotov cocktails, throwing anything they could, and that this ensued for the next two Fridays before they finally got directives from Damascus, in spite of the fact they were begging for weapons to defend themselves. It was at least 3 weeks that they were there before they got weapons. And by this point, these so-called spontaneous unarmed protesters had taken over Daraa, and they'd set up checkpoints and essentially, in a very military fashion, taken over the city. So, I mean, I think these are things that we don't hear in the corporate media and that defy this whole narrative of unarmed protesters. The other points that many people, aside from me, have raised are that, in general, revolutions don't start in border towns, especially not towns bordering your enemy, Israel. And also that there had been Facebook calls for protest in Damascus in February and January, and that basically there had been no turnout. Also, I'm sure some of your other guests have already spoken about this in the past, but there were massacres committed in the early months that, again, most of these corporate media wouldn't talk about. There was the slaughter of Nidal Janoud in Banias in April 2011, and there were actual massacres of civilians and of soldiers in those early months. And, you know, this is an important factor because it does defy this mythology that for the first 6 months or even year, this was just all about, you know, calling for revolution.
Well, that's another thing that is ignored is that Bashar al-Assad was the president from 2000 to 2011, almost 12 years, peacefully, without any incidents, and not having shooting in the streets or civil war or rebel groups, etc. And originally, it just became the Arab Spring. Like, oh, Arabs are just rebelling now, first nothing. And you saw Qatar's media outfit try to spin what happened in Benghazi and along with the Clinton administration, because I don't call it the Obama administration because the State Department was running the show, they were blaming Benghazi on an offensive movie on YouTube and ignoring the prior attempts on Ambassador Stevens' life. Now, weapons from Libya, the surplus weapons and others, were shipped through Lebanon into Syria, and that was reported, you know, boatloads of weapons, you know, prior to this outbreak of snipings happening and as it was happening. And so this was premeditated. And when you're talking about being on the border of Israel, Syria's enemy, I mean, of course, Israel thinks all of Golan Heights is theirs. Assad's father took 30% of it back during the Yom Kippur conflict. But Israel policymakers wrote out exactly what they wanted to happen in Syria with Oded Yanan, and then later the clean break. And we were talking about Iraq war architects like Richard Perl, who were the Defense Policy Board chairman in the DOD during the conflict in Iraq. And then so this magical date comes in 2011 because December 2010, the American troops are removed from Iraq, and now they say they can have Al-Qaeda in Iraq move in to create ISIS. And our own DIA has admitted that. Michael Flynn, the general for the DIA, has admitted that. They were going to have the Muslim Brotherhood, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and all these Salafist groups make a principality, and oust Bashar al-Assad. They literally wrote down what they were going to do before they did it, and yet the mass media still continues to say it was an organic uprising by rebels, and we're supporting the moderates. Now, I want to ask you about this myth of moderate rebels. Who exactly are these moderate rebels? I mean, is Afar al-Sham really moderate? Because technically that's what they're labeled as such.
I personally don't know who the moderates are, and neither do Syrians. Most, you know, Syrians I've met in Aleppo, in Homs, in various cities I've traveled to in six visits to Syria. I mean, Ahrar al-Sham is part of a coalition that have besieged the villages of Fuh and Kafraya for years and have been moderately bombing these people and sniping at children. And they've also partaken in the bombing of Aleppo, you know, by gas canister water heater bombs and by conventional Grad missiles and mortars and explosive bullets.
But so moderate explosive bullets and moderate gas canisters.
Yeah, and now I'm going to try to pull up an article to reference what I'm about to assert. But I was writing a rebuttal to a Guardian claim about chemical weapons usage in Syria. And I'll just explain very quickly. Basically, The Guardian was one of many of these establishment media that in April of this year April this year, were all asserting that a hospital in eastern Aleppo called Al-Quds was destroyed, as they most media put it. It was destroyed by either Syrian or Russian airstrikes, right?
Yeah.
And then some months later in September, The Guardian was now saying that this hospital in the Al-Sukri district, which is like southeast Aleppo, was treating victims of chemical weapons attacks, implying, of course, again, that the Syrians and the Russians had done this. So this hospital regenerated itself. What were we talking about that made me go off on that tangent?
Well, we were talking about Al-Sham, but to this story that you're saying, I remember Guyana from RT talking to John Kirby, who I think she gives nightmares to, about this, and she pulled up pictures of this hospital, and it had not been bombed. And he goes, is this the hospital you're talking about? Can you show me the hospital you're talking about? It's always the last hospital in Aleppo. This is the last chair in Aleppo. This is the last cat in Aleppo. It's always the last something. Yeah, the last clown in Aleppo. That's not sarcasm, folks. That's really the last clown, the last zoo, that's been said.
It's absurd, you know. It's absurd how much we're expected to believe, and how many how many punches they pull in these last whatevers, the last tweets, right? A few days ago, we were seeing that this is going to be my last tweet, and then the next day they were on BBC or whatever.
BBC, Al Jazeera, and CNN, the forefront of corporate news networks that lied about everything else, and these people. I mean, you look at that, and to me, it was as stupid as these Toyota trucks that ISIS has by the hundreds, all of the same brand new paint, you know, with artillery pieces they got in Croatia. And then you see these people, and like, I have friends in Damascus who have to use a car battery just to get on the internet to get electricity. And so they're saying, oh, I'm in Aleppo with Wi-Fi and an iPad and brand new clothing, and I'm on the internet, and I already have thousands of Twitter followers, and I'm going to put out my last tweet.
When I was in Aleppo, you know, I stayed because I only was allowed to stay in hotels for my own security, I guess is the reason. So I stayed in two different hotels, one of which had better Wi-Fi. And even then, it was a struggle to get onto my Hotmail, let alone Twitter, you know. So the notion that this, like, that these activists or this 7-year-old girl, Bana al-Abed, is tweeting, like, you know, 10, 20, 30, or even two times a day consistently, it's not logical. They don't, you know, the internet is not that good. I mean, unless they're getting supplied with 4G cards from Turkey, which is a possibility, then I think that it's implausible they're actually, all of them are actually in eastern Aleppo. But you were asking about moderates, so I was trying to find, and maybe I can find it later and send it to you for a link, but I was trying to find an article which basically notes that while the U.S. will not publicly name Ahrar al-Sham as terrorists, in one of their own documents talking about financing for the year 2017, they actually do name them as terrorists. So it's just interesting.
That group got an al-Qaeda middleman, a bagman for Mohammed Atta. His name is Mohammed Zammar. He was in prison in Syria. And in a prisoner swap, they got him out of jail. This isn't just al-Qaeda. This is an al-Qaeda member who was directly involved in the September 11th attacks, helping finance the Hamburg cell, which ended up crashing a plane into the World Trade Center in New York. And, I mean, that this guy is even alive is special. But, you know, the Moroccans caught him. He ended up being thrown in jail in Syria because that's where he originated from. And they got him out of jail. And so how can they not be considered terrorists when their primary objective in their prisoner swap was to get out al-Qaeda commanders? And this guy went right back to it. Once he got out of jail, went into financing al-Qaeda again. No consequences in the State Department in the U.S. They refuse to label these people as a terrorist group because they need them to be the conduit to finance and arm ISIS and al-Nusra.
Yeah, and I think people might recall the German journalist, his interview with an al-Nusra commander. And the al-Nusra commander comes right out and says, yes, we received the TOW missiles. And yes, we've received, you know, directly received weaponry from the West. By naming some of these groups as moderates and then arming them under this ridiculous pretext of fighting ISIS, when, as you mentioned just a little while ago, the U.S. has consistently accidentally airdropped supplies to ISIS and turned a blind eye to their huge convoys rolling through the, you know, hundreds of miles of desert, it's just ridiculous. And some of the other moderates, quote unquote, include, you know, the group that methodically sawed the head off of a Palestinian child, 12 or 13-year-old Abdullah Issa. And the U.S., as far as I know, has not condemned that. I think they basically just said, oops.
You have Palestinians fighting on the Syrian side alongside Assad. You've had Palestinians who've been living in Syria, who took refuge in Syria because of the Israelis, and had lived there for a number of years. And so they are fighting. They're one of the brigades even. There's a whole Palestinian brigade fighting these terrorists and on the side of Assad. And so they cut this young kid's head off. And I believe the White Helmets were there to film that and celebrate.
Yeah, what's his name? Mahmoud Razlan, who's also, he was there. He's been filmed taking selfies with these al-Nusra terrorists, and when they were specifically with that boy, Abdullah Issa. And he's also the guy that later took a photo of this boy named Amran, apparently.
Oh, the orange hair.
Yeah, the ambulance boy. So the boy that had what could have been a head wound, could or could not, we don't know. But the fact is, assuming it's a head wound, the appropriate medical action apparently was to sit him on a chair and not administer any sort of, you know, first aid, and simply just to take photos of him. I mean, it was so ludicrous. And the guy that took one of the photos that was splashed on all corporate media front pages and websites was this Mahmoud Razlan, who himself has taken selfies with the child beheaders.
Laughing about it. And you see the Israelis in al-Nusra front with pictures together. The man that took those photos was killed. And I know that the names, folks, I'm just terrible at pronouncing some of these Arabic names, so I leave it to Ava to do. But yeah, the boy in the orange chair, as Hillary called him, she couldn't mention his name. She got his age wrong too. Into the debates, she said that boy in the orange chair. Really, I mean, you know how many children have been dying in this conflict, and this is your photo op, which was done earlier this year in 2016. That's what you're going to parade around. I mean, how about when your terrorist organization, Al-Sham, went in and machine gunned all those women and hung the children up and burned them in front of everybody, over 40 kids. I didn't see that on the Clinton News Network. The criteria for naming somebody a terrorist organization or not is whether or not they have obedience to the United States. I mean, they took MEK off the terrorist watch list. It's just ridiculous. Mm-hmm. So we're routinely financing Jandala. I mean, we help create Al-Qaeda. The Northern Alliance in Afghanistan is raping boys and things. They're just as bad as the Taliban. It's just not really based on whether or not they commit acts of terror. It's just based whether or not of, are you killing people we don't like?
Right.
You see. As for Aleppo, the last tweets, I mean, that's been pretty thoroughly debunked, but I see now that, I mean, the Israeli news even called it a Holocaust, which is amazing. I was waiting for that one. I didn't know that was going to pop up, but and yet we see unbroken live feeds from RT of the residents escaping the terrorists and welcoming and cheering on the forces of the SS or the SAA. And so they want to act like there's this humanitarian crisis, and yet the residents have said that, and this is on film, that boxes of medical and aid food are now finally being uncovered because what was meant for civilians was being hoarded by the terrorists. And no reporting on that from the Alphabet Soup networks, even though it's on film and people are there on the ground. Where is the corporate media getting their information?
Yeah, I mean, it's true that they're not reporting on, really on the, If you're following media on the ground in Syria, they're not reporting, the corporate media is not reporting on the jubilation of these people. So roughly estimates of 90,000 to 100,000. This is what I've seen from somebody I know who was recently on the ground in Aleppo, in eastern Aleppo, and visited this Jibreen Center, which had registered people, refugees coming from eastern Aleppo. And so it's at least 90,000 people, perhaps 100,000 people. The corporate media is not talking about this, and they're not talking about the hell that these people lived through, including, like you referred to, you know, being starved because the terrorist factions were hoarding the food, being denied medical care because the terrorist factions were hoarding medical supplies and had taken over hospitals. None of this is being reported. Instead, in a concerted effort, the corporate media entities are reporting on manufactured massacres. One of their sources is a United Nations spokesperson who alleges there has been a massacre by the Syrian army against civilians, in eastern Aleppo. This was, I think, on December 13th. And he doesn't provide a single source. And I don't know, tell me, how credible is it to say in a UN official statement, we've heard, and then accuse the Syrian government of this? And he is the basis for all the corporate media that have reported, you know, 82 civilians slaughtered by the Syrian army. It always comes back to this one UN press release with no sources. But I mean, other media over the years, when they've been reporting, and particularly this year, when they've been reporting on last hospitals or any of the, you know, absurdities, last doctors, etc., and when they've been reporting on, you know, accusations of targeting civilians in eastern Aleppo and other areas of Syria, it boils down to them relying on certain very non-credible organizations like the White Helmets, like the SOHR, the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, which is not based in Syria and has not, which he is not based in Syria and has not been in Syria for at least 10, 15 years. He is
right,
one
that
person.
That sounds like that's a fancy name. And it sounds like, oh, the observatory, like it's a team of officials that do statistics, and it's one guy in the UK.
Yes.
That's amazing. It's like Weekly Standard reporting with when they erroneously said that Iraq passed anthrax to Al-Qaeda members, which helped start the war in Iraq because Colin Powell went to the UN with a mock vial of anthrax, and the official reason was, oh, they're breaking UN Resolution 1441. That was based on just, they said Israeli security forces witnessed it. Well, they didn't, because Mohammed Atta wasn't even in Prague, and the FBI knew that because they knew he was in Florida at the time. So it didn't matter. They just ran the story anyway and got the war they wanted. It's that bad. Just, oh, we heard that. Blah, fill in the blank with whatever they want to do anyway. So
yeah,
how does that happen? That alone, like, okay, you have one guy who's calling himself the Observatory of Syrian Human Rights Observatory. That should be reported, because that should be shocking. Like, really? That's your source? Some British guy that's never been there? And how would he know any of this?
Yeah, I mean, it should be reported. But no, it's, I mean, The point is that he's iterating the narrative that that the corporate media, which are themselves largely projecting this narrative that, you know, the NATO alliance want to project. So they don't deem to question. Yet when independent people actually go to Syria, take testimonies, have video and photo and audio recordings of these testimonies of people in Syria and what they're saying and what they actually want, somehow we are deemed as fake news. You know, it's beyond absurd. You know, and other partial sources are for example, the head of Human Rights Watch. Human Rights Watch itself is not an impartial institution, and its head Ken Roth has repeatedly, you know, called for President Assad to step down. He's repeatedly mistweeted photos and videos alleging to be, you know, areas that have supposedly been bombed by the Syrians or the Russians, and later retracted, saying, "Oops, you know, it was Gaza, it was Shajai. Sorry, it wasn't Aleppo." And you know, other sources like groups that are directly funded by the very countries that are warring upon Syria. So the White Helmets, or this group called the Syria Campaign, or this Facebook page called the Aleppo Media Center, all funded by the US, UK, and EU, etc.
We mentioned a couple times, but for it might be inside baseball, the White Helmets, this British org. Can you talk about them a bit? I also want to add that my coffee was cold this morning, so I blame Russian hackers.
Yes. So, you know, I would really recommend to people to look up the writings of Vanessa Bealey, who contributes to 21st Century Wire, Rick Sterling, who's a colleague that contributes to Dissident Voice.
I'm actually hoping to have Vanessa on later today.
I absolutely hope that you do, because she's one of the ones. I have a few colleagues that have been on the ground in East Aleppo just recently, and she's one of the ones that has, I can't imagine how many testimonies from people that would directly contradict the lies of the corporate media. But essentially, the White Helmets were formed in 2013 with the funding from the US and UK, which now amounts to at least $100 million, and not just the US, UK, but also EU states and other nations around the world. They are only found in Al-Qaeda areas. They purport to be neutral, yet can be found in their Facebook selfies, you know, engaging with terrorists and themselves holding weapons and standing in the dead bodies of Syrian soldiers. And the other point I think to note is that, you know, so now Aleppo is almost completely secured and liberated of the militants that infested it. And the people that Vanessa was meeting, the people that other journalists, Syrian and foreign journalists on the ground in East Aleppo were meeting, if they were posed the question, you know, did the White Helmets rescue you, your neighbors, have you seen the White Helmets? Usually they're saying, wait, what? You know, and I interviewed IDPs from East Aleppo when I was there in November. And the ones that I met had escaped eastern areas of Aleppo in late October. And I said, you know, have you heard of the White Helmets? Are they, you know, because they're apparently all over East Aleppo rescuing you. They hadn't heard of them. Okay, so I interviewed these two families and spoke with people, residents of West Aleppo or Greater Aleppo, who have family in then occupied eastern areas of Aleppo. They hadn't heard of these White Helmets. And you would think, you know, if the allegations of the media were true, and if the people in eastern Aleppo were really being, you know, assaulted all the time by the Syrian government and Russians, and if they're really being dug out of the rubble, as the White Helmets purport, by these so-called rescuers, you would think that they'd be telling their relatives and loved ones in West Aleppo, but they weren't. Clearly, they are a propaganda tool, and they've been very effective. They're very slick, you know, with all that money, they would be slick, the propaganda videos. And it went to such an extent that they were put up for the nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize.
Well, that's what you get when you wage war. I mean, Obama got a Nobel Peace Prize, even though he bombed Pakistan his third day in office. And they gave him the prize because supposedly he was going to reduce the number of nuclear weapons, but all he did was play schematics where he counted warheads on a plane and said, well, it's only one plane, so we'll count that as one weapon. He didn't really reduce the number at all. But, yeah, Nobel Peace Prize. And they've screwed up sometimes, even with their hundreds of millions of dollars, though, recycling the same kid over and over.
Yeah, so, I mean, I made that point. So maybe now I can just take a moment to address this. There's a bit of controversy going around a press conference that I and some others did at the UN.
I wanted to, I didn't know if you're aware or not, but there's a Snopes article hit piece on you. Of course, Snopes is just one guy and his wife in a basement. So.
how very similar to other propagandists.
they did during the election. I'm always going to Snopes and debunking the debunking. They tried to say that, oh, Hillary Clinton didn't help get a rapist's sentence reduced. And that I thoroughly debunked that. But they like to cherry pick information. I've busted them many times. And I'm like, why do people read Snopes? What is this? And it's because it was mentioned in a vice presidential debate. And so automatic free advertising right there. And it's just some guy who doesn't know anything about anything. It's fine if you're debunking utter nonsense, you know, Bigfoot, Loch Ness Monster type stuff, but every time it gets into politics, they just lie.
Yeah, so a friend of mine did message me, and I'll just preface this by saying I've been really busy the last week and haven't had much time to address many messages that have flooded my inbox. But a friend messaged me, so I just got it open now, and I can I can take a quick look, but what I want to say first, before I get into the Snopes thing and the BuzzFeed and other things I've seen, I've been tagged in on Facebook, and even today during an interview with Russia Today, this came up. So what people are saying is that I'm an apparatus of Russia and Syrian state media, that I'm being paid by them to say these things, that I'm their, however you want to phrase it. They're essentially saying I'm spewing the line of the Russians and the Syrians' agenda. And they're also implying or coming right out and saying that, you know, I'm paid to go to Syria and say these things. The thing, if anybody who knows me sees the state of my clothing would know if I'm getting paid, I'm certainly not using my money wisely. But the other thing is, I mean,
that's okay. I got accused of working for the CIA and the NSA. I'm like, really? Because I'm doing a really bad job because I've never said anything positive about either one of them, and I'm certainly not getting paid.
Exactly. And the thing, I mean, many of us who do work in independent alternative media do so. We actually pour our own money into doing what we're doing. And, you know, I might spend a week on an article and get paid $50 and other times not get paid anything. So it's certainly not for the money. And I'm not, for the record, I'm not getting paid by either Russia or Syria or any government, unlike some other journalists might be. I pay my own expenses. You know, I've paid my expenses to Syria. In many cases, like the last time I went when I went this summer, I had to fundraise. So I had to beg people to fund me to go to Syria. And that's actually a very humbling thing to do, you know, to say, I'm so broke, I need your support to go do this. Mm-hmm. But in
you
fact,
went to
that's
Gaza
how I
by flotilla, yeah.
Yeah, I went to Gaza by boat in November 2008. That was part of the breaking the siege before it became a big trend to do the flotilla.
Right.
That's a story in itself.
Unfortunately, that whole thing has been tainted by charlatans like Ken O'Keefe, who raise $100,000 and then just move to Dominica and play with it. You know, that's sad when other people are soaking up donations that are meant to help people in real need and journalists who can really help them more than anyone else. And you get these charlatans coming around and taking over $100,000 with nothing to show for it. And it puts a stigma on the whole thing. And, you know, we'd like to have more flotillas, but because of the actions of people like that, it just creates a tar baby and it ruins it all. But I know for certain you're not getting a paycheck from Vladimir Putin or anything like that. I mean, Russia wasn't even involved really in the Syrian conflict in the beginning. It's when the Chechen rebels started to join the Al-Qaeda forces that it became in Russian interest.
Yeah, and I just add that it's so supremely arrogant of, clearly the people that are saying these things about people like myself or any independent person that goes to Syria and reports from on the ground, the people are saying that have an agenda of discrediting our voices, but also, you know, from commentators, who deem themselves either academics or leftists or whatever their title is, to say when I say, you know, when I've traveled around Syria and spoken at length with Syrians around the country and Syrians in Lebanon who for various reasons are living there, working there, trying to support their families back in Syria, and I say, you know, if I want to give an estimate, like 95% of the Syrians I've met are supportive of their government, many of them even to the extent that they love their president. But, you know, when I say things like that, okay, I'm called a propagandist. When I report the realities of terrorists, when I call them terrorists, and they are terrorists, I'm called a propagandist, even though that's what Syrians themselves call them, and they don't differentiate between FSA, Ahrar al-Sham, al-Nusra, or ISIS.
They're terrorists because they engage in terrorism. I mean, it's
precisely.
I don't care what the official designation is. If you're chopping off people's heads, there's no moderate way to do that. If you're eating people's organs, there's no moderate way to do that. They've been grilling body parts. I mean, these are really disgusting, disturbed people. And they're not Syrian. This is, you know, multiple countries we now know financed openly by Qatar and Saudi Arabia. Are pouring into Syria. It's Operation Ajax 3.0, Iran-Contra 2.0. I mean, it's the same modus operandi that we've seen again and again, where, you know, the U.S. and the Safari Club crew go in, and like France and Saudi Arabia, go in and use Wahhabi cannon fodder to fight their battles for them. I mean, these useful idiots. And Israel's been laughing the whole time. They wrote out, if we can get the Arabs to kill each other. I mean, that's what the plan has been the entire time, and they want to demonize Assad. So going back a bit, though, rewinding, the claim that they've recycled pictures of the same child, like in different cities, is what they're trying to call you out on. So if you have an example of that, we can clear that up right now.
Yeah, so they take one of the incidents I was referring to of a girl dressed in green. Her hair is teased up and looks wild, and she looks like she's been injured, you know. And this is a girl that they're saying has been injured by either airstrikes or barrel bombs. Take your pick. Now, what I was referring to, and unfortunately I didn't have dates on hand, but I can certainly find them and refute their denials. I was referring to that girl and the fact that she did turn up within a series of months, a period of months, in different locations of Aleppo and outskirts of Aleppo. Same girl, different locations, different incidents. That's what I was referring to. I see that Snopes has taken the one of the ones that I was referring to and then pulled something of a girl named Aya from 2013. I was not referring to that girl, and I'm not saying that in all the ones that I did refer to, they're all called Aya. I said there's a girl who's named Aya in some of them, and that she does reappear in different stories, different timelines. So, I mean, I'd be happy. I am going to work on a rebuttal on this when I have some time. But the fact is, you can do a search. I mean, there have people. Tim Anderson, for example, has done a graphic showing this little girl and showing how she turns up in two different or three different locations, different dates, and it's the same girl.
Oh well, I remember talking with Maram Sisley about a girl. I think her name was Aya as well, who was supposedly starving to death, and the parent of the girl whose picture they were actually using was saying, no, that's my daughter, and she's here, and she's not in Syria, and she's not starving.
That girl was Mariana Meze. And like you said, they and I'm glad you brought this up, because the Madaya thing is another example of propaganda, and really the media looking away from what's actually was happening in Madaya and is still happening, and putting all the blame on the Syrians and concocting these allegations against them. But yeah, in that one, in that campaign, which overnight all media were talking about Madaya suddenly in early January,
cared about Madaya, and it all came at once, all uniformly. Madaya, 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 and look at this little girl. It was babies on incubator level consorted effort on this. And the thing is that the government actually had been sending aid to Madaya, but these rebel groups had been hoarding it. And not only that, they were selling it to the local population at exuberant prices, just extortion, selling aid. That I think PBS did cover that, but other than that, there was nothing that I saw in mass media.
Yeah, so the on October 18th, the spokesperson for the ICRC, the Red Cross, issued a statement saying that they had sent in enough supplies to last for several months. And at the end of December 2015, ICRC, UN, and the Syrian Red Crescent were able to evacuate some of the injured and wounded from Madaya. But at that time, December 2015, no mention, no mass media mention of, you know, a manifestation of starving people in Madaya. And yet, come January, in spite of the entry of food, as the ICRC person, spokesperson testified in October, suddenly everybody's starving, according to the media. At the same time, you know, finally when journalists did get in around mid-January, they were interviewing people in Madaya, and they were saying precisely what you just said, that the people were blaming the terrorists who were hoarding the food and charging them prices they couldn't afford. And there were also, you could find video footage of people inside Madaya protesting, just like in Yarmouk, protesting the fact that the terrorists were there and they wanted them out. Yarmouk is another perfect example. Yarmouk was a card played to vilify, and all the media were talking about it, and all the so-called leftists and pro-Palestinian activists were talking about it, blaming Syria. And even though there was documentation from within that terrorists were doing the same thing, hoarding food, firing on civilians, Yarmouk was made out to be the blame of the Syrian government. Now, nobody talks about Madaya or Yarmouk. And notably, at the same time as Madaya, two very real two villages that were really suffering and still are suffering, Fu and Kafraya, the media wasn't making any mention of them, even though they had been besieged far longer than the military siege on Madaya. And, you know, another notable thing about Madaya was that there were like 600 terrorists within from FSA, Ahrar al-Sham, and al-Nusra. Mm-hmm. These same terrorist factions are besieging and surrounding these villages of Fu and Kafraya, and they're firing upon them daily. And, you know, when we were talking about Amran and his head wound and how he became this poster child, around that time, two boys from Fu and Kafraya, you know, they were the perfect candidates for poster child children of Syrian suffering. One had been sniped in his neck and the other had been sniped in his head. And they were like 4 and 6 years old, and nobody spoke about them.
No, well, at home around the same time in the Department of Homeland Security's press spokesman got caught raping a 5-year-old and a 9-year-old. So, I mean, this is the kind of thing that doesn't get in air, and they don't care about children. It wasn't on their teleprompters, so, you know, Madaya may be easier to say, so they chose that village. I mean, I swear it's that simple. Like, it's the names that the talking heads can go over. It's something that the, oh, let's use this town because the public can remember this name better. So we'll ignore these other two. They're too Arabic sounding. Like, I swear they make decisions like that. They didn't care. And you don't hear anything about Madaya now. I mean, it's like, we're on to the next thing. And Aleppo is a Holocaust, they said on Israeli news. It's amazing. And what are they going to do when all these people who are being freed from Aleppo, you know, they're out now. So they're going to say who the terrorists were, and they're going to say who rescued them. I mean, they're really just going to say it's all Russian propaganda?
I suspect that's one of the main reasons. I think there's two reasons that the corporate media are specifically not reporting what these people are telling Syrian and Russian and independent media on the ground in Aleppo. I think one of the reasons is that they don't want to acknowledge that their plan has failed, and that, you know, due to the, you know, with the help of the Russians, Hezbollah, and other regional allies, the Syrian army has cleansed Aleppo of the terrorists. And I think a couple of reasons are acknowledging, like you said, the crimes that these terrorists were committing to the people, not just on the people of greater Aleppo, the 1.5 million, but the people they were essentially holding hostage in eastern Aleppo. And I think a third point is that the United Nations has for years been saying 250,000, because it's a greater number and therefore will affect people more. Now 100,000 have come out, and there's a very small pocket, I don't know if it's 2 or 3 square miles, that militants remain in, and we're expected to believe that 150,000 remain in that very small area. So I think that might be another reason why corporate media isn't addressing what's actually happened, you know, recently. Instead, they're deflecting and pumping out these new allegations and accusations.
I think fourth, too, they're using the "it's a Holocaust" narrative to foster more aid and support, because you have a lot of well-meaning, kind people who are donating their money and resources to these, you know, NGOs and organizations that are just going to waste it on guns and, you know, Turkey especially. But if France is just up their aid to northern Syria on the pretext of, oh, boo-hoo Aleppo. but you know where this aid is really going, and you know it's not all Band-Aids and food. They've been giving them arms, weapons, etc. Al-Nusra has also been treated in Israeli hospitals, so they're photographed together. It just doesn't seem, there's nothing that seems to break the narrative, no matter how many times they get caught, who they're photographed with, showing up with U.S. weapons, driving around in Toyota Hilux trucks, which were part of Obama's non-lethal aid package. No amount seems to break the narrative of these AJ plus people who say Assad's a monster, Assad must go. And they never have an answer like, okay, if Assad goes, then what? What comes next? How'd that work out with Saddam and Gaddafi? Like, are you going to have one of these rebel groups in charge of Syria? Is it, and oh, no, we'll just cross that bridge when we come to it. We just got to get rid of Assad. Got to get rid of Assad. No answer to what comes next.
Yeah, and it really surprises me that people aren't exercising critical thinking on that. You know, that's a very good question.
Wait, does that surprise you?
Or is, well... That just- Maybe because I surround myself with people who do critically think, so I'm surprised at how many people don't. I mean, honestly, to believe that the 7-year-old girl, this lie alone, to believe that the 7-year-old girl in East Aleppo supposedly has constant internet access and is able to tweet about Holocaust, genocides, and asking for no-fly zones. I mean, when I was 7, I don't know what my vocabulary was, and I'm a native English speaker, so it's
right.
But people believe this, you know.
I have a 7-year-old who's very smart. I mean, I guess they're saying her mom helps or whatever, but she joins Twitter in September. She has 288,000 followers last time I looked at it. It's probably more than that now. And of course, she had a "I'm about to die" note too, and she's not. She'll be there tomorrow.
Yeah, and you know, there's an article a woman named Barbara McKenzie wrote. She's got a blog, barbaramckenzie.wordpress.com, and in late November she wrote an article, and she's updated it since. But it's actually a really interesting investigation into the evolution of Bana, the girl, the 7-year-old girl. And as you mentioned, she has a mass number of followers, and I'm just trying to find out where.
Again, yeah, Bana, so she, a very easy name to pronounce. This is all PR. I mean, Obana, I can remember that.
Okay, so she, I'm going to quote from her article because it's, I think, pretty interesting. She says, "We Bana hit the ground running on 24th September with about 20 tweets, and she has continued at a good rate ever since, managing over 120 tweets on October 4th, including retweets. She said, I myself used Twitter for weeks before. I used hashtags, and I was slow to learn the jargon. Bana, however, was up to speed from the beginning, and over the first 2 days, we got hashtag Aleppo, hashtag Holocaust Aleppo, blah, blah, blah." Okay, so that might be her mom helping her or her.
Hashtag
but there's
Holocaust Aleppo is something spun by Israeli media, because no one else would exaggerate that, you know, must 6 million. Nobody would do that because, come on, that's too over the top. So I'm starting to see the origins of this one because nope.
Yeah,
as bad
and,
as lies are, no one said Holocaust yet. I mean, nobody's being thrown into ovens. It's not gotten that extreme point, but sorry.
So, and just a couple more things from this article that I think might, you know, shake people a little bit. She said after a few weeks or within a few days, she'd built up a huge following. So she started on, what was it, September 24th. By October 3rd, she has 65,000 followers.
Right.
I mean, she's a Twitter genius, you know. I don't know, or else like Gay Girl in Damascus, like many frauds we've seen in this war on Syria.
Oh she, wait, she, tell explain Gay Girl in Damascus, because that's one of my favorites.
You know, actually, you might be better versed. I'm just aware that there was somebody who was posing as a gay girl in Damascus.
Okay, well that was early on, and. And this guy, it was a man, he had a, "Oh my God, they're coming for me right now. This is my last tweet." He had one of these too.
Right.
And it was a man. He was heterosexual. It wasn't a woman. It wasn't a lesbian. And they weren't in Damascus. It was a guy in England. And he made it up. But
amazing.
They were going to him like they go to these couch potatoes for news sources, because it fit the narrative of Assad being such an evil monster. And at that time was when they were doing all the Pussy Riot propaganda against Russia, and, "Oh, Putin hates homosexuals, da, da, da." So it sort of fit with the theme, and that's what they rolled with, and it was just a guy.
Well, I don't know if listeners or viewers were aware of Syrian Danny or not, but he's another propaganda agent that was caught flat-out lying.
Right, Danny boy, that's true.
Yeah,
I forget the, I mean, when you said that, oh yeah, I remember that, but that one slipped my mind.
Yeah, I mean, that was a fascinating case in which he was purporting to be in Homs. He might have been in Homs, in fact, but he was purporting to be surrounded by attacks. And, you know, he was the go-to man for, what's the guy's name on CNN? Blanking on his name right now.
Was it Blitzer or Cooper?
Cooper, that's who it was, Anderson Cooper. And so, in fact, I on my last trip to Syria, I actually met the Syrian journalist who broke the story of Sirian Dani. Basically, this journalist was on, I don't know the technology, but he was on the channel or the feed, which was open, and which Cooper, you know, would eventually open up the interview with Sirian Dani with. And this feed, a satellite feed, was open, apparently, you know, open until Cooper would start the interview. So it was being recorded as Dani calmly stood there, took drags on a ciggy, asked for coffee and a mattress, and there was like no explosives, no bombings, you know, no sounds of war. And then he was instructed by the cameraman or someone off camera how, what to say, how he would react, that there would be bombings, what numbers to say. And then as soon as the feed went rolling, he suddenly lost the calm demeanor and started looking, you know, frantically left and right and speaking quickly. You know, it was also very clearly staged.
Well, that's what CNN did during the first Gulf War. They were in Florida and they said they were in Saudi Arabia. And they even had, like, let's sound an alarm. And so they're, nee, nee, you know, the whole thing, the cutting room floor footage finally leaked. And you can see that now on the internet, where they're just saying they're in Saudi Arabia during the Gulf War with Scud missiles coming. And they were in Tampa. I made the whole thing up.
Oh, and another incident I can give is a friend of mine. She lives in Latakia. She's American but married to a Syrian, has lived there for about 20 years. And she was pointing to, or she was referring to, an example of lies in the LA Times in early to mid-2011 when they were claiming that all these protests, unarmed protests, were occurring in Latakia where she lived. And she said, Eva, I went around Latakia doing errands that day, and every place that they said there were protests occurring in, I was there and there were none. And she said she tried to contact the editor to the LA Times and, you know, didn't get any reply or retraction to this article.
Let's make this a game. Do you remember when they were reporting about the protest in Libya and they said, oh, this is in Tripoli, and this was on the BBC, and they had footage of a rally in India, and they actually had flags from India in the background, which don't even remotely resemble the flag of Libya, not even the new one. It's from India.
Wow.
A little bit, you could confuse that with Iran maybe, but how do you say this in Tripoli? And it didn't matter. Like, after the fact, how did that get through all the filters on BBC? Oh, yeah, here's a rally. Like, oh, there's lots of people. They're brown. That'll work. They'll never know.
Oh, I mean, gosh.
Yeah, well, I'm not seeing that. That's what I think they think. The Saddam statue toppling is another one where they had armored vehicles blocking the entrances to this park, and the army took the statue down, and they brought in these rent-a-crowd to come in and hit it with shoes and stuff. And, you know, these idiots, that just a couple of days before, they had at the Palestinian Hotel, Ahmed Shalabi, who was convicted of bank fraud and ended up becoming Iraq's new oil minister. He's there with his goons, and then you see these same individuals in the Saddam statue toppling, faces and all running around like they were just organic, jubilant Iraqis that were glad the Americans came, and oh, what a bad guy. And these were the government-in-waiting crew out there celebrating and hitting the statue with shoes. They had been brought in there, and that got debunked right away. Antiwar.com had it up, and nothing on CNN or anything. You know, even now, they won't admit it. It's just, even after the fact. And so that's the fake news.
Yeah.
That's the real fake news. They manufacture stories. It's not that they're incompetent and they just get it wrong. They make it up. It's deception. It's on purpose.
Yeah, and, you know, back to this Snopes article. The fact, you know, I mentioned in this UN press briefing, I said I was referring to the allegations by, you know, the corporate media, Human Rights Watch, all the usual suspects that the Russians or Syrians had destroyed, and that was the way it was being presented, destroyed a hospital named Al-Quds in eastern Aleppo. And I cited actually the RT journalist that you mentioned earlier. I forget her name. She's one. Yeah, and the fact that the Russian Ministry of Defense had satellite imagery of the hospital prior to its alleged destruction and in its current state, and there was no difference. And yet the Snopes, you know, doesn't take that. Even though I specifically mentioned this, they don't take that into account in their hit piece because they just want to, claim anybody who's speaking somewhat different from the corporate media narrative is fake news.
Gani, I hope we'll be in D.C. this March at the Stop APAC conference. I hope you can get down there, too, because I'd love to meet you. We're going to be down there. Yeah, she gives John Kirby nightmares, I think. And the press secretary just dodged the question. She's standing there with photographs of the hospital, and he's like, well, I mean, just put it to this. They have nothing to say. Just move along. Well, I can't speak to that. Or classified. It's so bad. And it doesn't matter. Like, you have to almost unbrainwash people on a one-on-one basis, like calmly sit them down and go over it all, because it's just the lies are so numerous, it's overwhelming. Like, okay, this one and this one was fake. What about all these other ones? Look.
Yeah, I actually had a friend a couple of days ago message me. She knows, you know, how involved I've been in this in trying to share information on the war in Syria. And anyway, she's seen some of this propaganda, recent propaganda about, massacres and genocides in Aleppo. And she sent me a message, well-intentioned, saying, I'm so sorry, your heart must be broken. And I replied back like, no, actually, I'm very happy because Aleppo's been liberated. Why would my heart be broken?
Yeah.
And I knew, and I just said, listen, when I'm back in Ontario, I'll sit down and explain this all to you because I just don't have time right now. But I said, please, whatever you do, please don't fall for whatever you're seeing in the corporate media, because I guarantee you they're lying. And I know what she was seeing. She was seeing all these fake reports.
It's the last tweet of Aleppo from the last doctor at the last hospital.
Exactly. What, you know, on my first trip to Aleppo, because I'd been hearing all these last doctors and hospitals hit, I went to the Aleppo Medical Association to find out how many last doctors they had, and they had 4,160 registered and active doctors. You know, so of course the corporate media is only referring to these pockets of eastern Aleppo occupied then by terrorists, and then of course they were manufacturing stories about doctors. Some of these people aren't even doctors. Like, there's this one guy, Hamza al-Khatib, he didn't even finish his medical school, according to a source in Syria who we asked, and the Aleppo Medical Association has no record of him being a doctor. So he's a spokesperson a lot of people refer to when they're citing, you know,
right,
atrocities in Aleppo. They also, you know, if they want to talk about...
He's a doctor like Dr. Dre.
If people want to talk about hospitals hit, there are some very clear examples. One that I actually went to and visited myself was the Dabit Maternity Hospital, which, you know, if you're concerned about human rights and women in Syria, in Aleppo in particular, there's a perfect hospital to go visit because it was internally gutted by terrorist bombing and three women were killed. Little to no mention about this hospital. An even more significant example is the Kindi Hospital, which was truck bombed by terrorists in December 2013. And this was a massive cancer treatment hospital, the best of its kind in the Middle East.
Right, that's true.
I met with the director, Dr. Ibrahim Hadid. He used to be the director for 12 years at the Kindi, and he's now director of the University Hospital. So I met with him, and he was talking about it and how he was when it was first taken over by terrorists, he was doing everything he could to get, you know, world bodies like the WHO and the UN to condemn, you know, the fact that terrorists had taken over this hospital and were stealing the equipment or whatever. And then when it was destroyed, he said, nobody condemned it. You know, you would expect it. No, you wouldn't expect it.
How can the U.S. point a finger when they recently bombed a hospital in Afghanistan? And that was intentional. I mean, if it wasn't intentional, if you really screwed up your air coordinates that bad, then you shouldn't be bombing anything. Bombed a hospital in Afghanistan and killed hundreds in... it was in the news, but only to make excuses for it. Oh, well, that's how it goes, making excuses.
Yeah, they never, of course, never own up to those kind of criminal acts. They have bombed villages and, you know, civilians in Syria. And they, as you mentioned earlier, they've attacked Syrian positions. And they made excuses for that, even though it was an attack that lasted nearly 1 hour. And it was repeated attacks, including attacking Syrian soldiers who were visibly Syrian soldiers and retreating from the position.
The U.S. can't even acknowledge what happened to the USS Liberty, even with survivors today still alive, saying, we had American flags. We were attacked by unmarked planes. Like, who's an unmarked plane to attack what they think's an Egyptian boat? It just, they're not going to talk about it. I mean, it's never going to be on corporate news network. You have to see how the if you look at all these alphabet soup networks, their board of directors have overlapping membership with the biggest defense companies, which are corporate welfare queens. They get 99% of their revenue from the U.S. government. So, and some of them are multinational. That's where the other 1% comes from. It is really, truly something else. And we've got kids starving in Yemen. You're not going to see anything there because they're supporting Saudi Arabia bombing Yemen. Trump might reverse that policy. It's hard to tell because he says 50 different things all the time, but couldn't get worse than Hillary, I suppose. So,
I'd like to just give a couple of examples of corporate media who could have actually reported the truth. And I'm referring to in early November, and this is another thing I'd like to clarify, because one of these sleazy sites that's trying to defame me. So in November, from the 2nd to 5th, I joined a group of 13 Western journalist photographers who were going to Aleppo. I joined them, and the bus trip itself was taken care of by the Syrian government. However, we did pay for our own hotels, and that's the only time. I mean, otherwise, I was paying for my own transportation to and from Aleppo on other trips, and for my accommodation, of course, for my airfare, etc. So, just to clarify that, but we were at the Al Razi Hospital, which is one of the main hospitals in Aleppo, on November 3rd, when civilians that had been maimed and that had been killed came into the hospital and the morgue around the corner. And so journalist Anne Bernard from the New York Times and journalist from the BBC and from the LA Times were there. And I have to say, to their credit, the LA Times did write a reasonable article on that. But Anne Bernard's take on it, while she did report that, you know, some civilians were killed, it was 18 in total that day and 200 injured, she made it out to be something that was random, a one-off, something that didn't occur often. And we'd just been told the night before, we'd been in areas of Christian areas near the old city that were devastated by daily mortar and terror bombings. And so she made it out to be like, oh, well, this is, you know, unusual kind of thing. And then she had to qualify this massacre that we'd seen that day by saying, and according to the SOHR, the regime has bombed in southern Aleppo, you know, so contradicting
according to the guy in England.
Yeah, contradicting direct witness testimony and hearing the voices of civilians. One man talking about how he'd been from Jizr al-Shagur in western Syria, in Idlib, how he'd been run out by terrorists, how he was in Aleppo, how his mother had been killed by bombings, his cousin, his friends, and he was, you know, he was going crazy in his anguish. And, you know, we saw the women and children sitting around sobbing for their loved, you know, husbands or fathers or whomever.
It's terrible.
And yet she saw that too. And she does speak some Arabic. I heard her. So it wasn't that she wasn't informed. It was that she chose what she wanted to project. And one other example of that is that on the 4th, we were at a couple of humanitarian corridor crossings, one of which was the Castello Road crossing. And it was bombed twice by terrorist factions while we were there. And then 5 more times later on. And this was a day in which civilians theoretically could have left, and militants could have left areas of eastern Aleppo that were occupied, but the crossings were bombed. And she made it out to be, I forget exactly how she phrased it, but she made it out to be like it was unknown who bombed the crossing, implying it could have been the government sabotaging it. I mean, this is just an example. They complain that they can't get visas to Syria, which is not true. You have to apply, you have to pay, you have to wait, which I've done for months to get there, but you can get visas. And then when they're actually there, they don't report the whole truth.
Well, if she wants to keep her job, she's going to have to lie, because they know.
Yeah.
That's just how that is. And you look at even less or more neutral things like Gary Webb breaking his story on how narco traffic money was being diverted to help, you know, partially finance the Contras in Nicaragua. He got attacked by the Washington Post and all their editors and their CIA plants and everything else. And I mean, they really will pound somebody for telling the truth. And so the corporate news media, I mean, Iraq's the most perfect example, and that's what we were talking about in the beginning of this, is how, after all the lies about Iraq that you saw in the papers and on TV, why in the world would you believe these same talking heads and newspaper guys on Syria when they've done nothing but lie to you for over a decade? And now you're going to swallow this corporate news media. And I see a lot of people like Rula Jabril, the Palestinian, supports Palestinians, understands that conflict, how they're definitely occupied and Israel's building racial colonies in the West Bank. But then when it comes to Syria, completely on the corporate bandwagon.
Absolutely. And there's so many examples of that, including people who are, you know, known for popular websites like Electronic Intifada or Middle East Eye, and including Palestinians themselves, who have spewed this, you know, NATO or Gulf propaganda for years, and including people that are involved in the peace movement in the West and the U.S., and including people that are like on this group called the U.S. Campaign to End the Occupation. And I will name one. Her name is Rama Kudaimi, and she's a vicious, vitriolic piece of, you know, destructive human being that likes to go after and attack people who are defending Syria's sovereignty. And the thing is, Palestinians that do this, or people who support Palestine that do this, don't realize that they're actually defeating their own cause, because Syria has been one of the best supporters of Palestine.
Right.
And Palestinians in Syria have equal rights as Syrians. And as you mentioned earlier, there are many Palestinians fighting alongside the Syrian army and allies in, you know, in fighting this terrorism.
Well, a lot and of these actually, news outfits, they're not really pro-Palestine, they're pro-Hamas. And Hamas is not good for Palestine. It's the enemy Israel wants. They helped create Hamas. And so they get suckered into that sort of, they have that sort of Sunni Wahhabi flavor to them. Like, Hamas is just there to give a pretext for Israel to come in and collectively punish all of Gaza. That happens routinely. It was interesting that a story over here, and I don't know if you heard this or not, but a couple of Japanese guys had their heads cut off by ISIS.
Right.
A couple years ago. However, they had been in captivity from January to February, and then they got beheaded. The Japanese were so funny asking them about it. They should have killed themselves for allowing themselves to get captured, but that's how they are. But the moment Japan met with the boss in the West Bank, and Japan gave $100 million to Syria and $100 million to Palestine to rebuild. Now, note that they're going to be hiring Japanese companies. It is a trade deal, so it's a win-win. But $200 million basically for Syria and Palestine to rebuild themselves. An hour after that meeting and that deal was struck, these guys were paraded out and had their heads cut off. These two Japanese captives.
Oh, really?
An hour later. I mean, it's just like right after France recognized Palestine, there's a terror attack there. So, you know, Israeli intelligence is deep inside al-Nusra, and al-Nusra is ISIS. They're just wearing different hats and fly a different flag.
Yes.
But it's just the same people. And ISIS is just there to make – it's something a little more extreme to make the other ones seem more moderate.
It's like
Fox and MSNBC are there to make CNN look like it's in the middle.
Well, and that's a really good point. Like, because when corporate media and human rights groups and Western leaders talk about terrorism in Syria, they only talk about ISIS, and that's exactly why they want the others to seem moderate. Even though, as you alluded to earlier, the others have, you know, not only killed and beheaded, but they've eaten organs, grilled, sawed off heads.
John McCain met with him.
Yeah.
John McCain, Songbird McCain, whose father helped cover up the USS Liberty, Admiral McCain, he met with these organ-eating terrorists and had a photo op with them and everything else. But, yeah, I was talking to my friends in Damascus, a former engineer, you know, who's rigged up a car battery to have internet a couple hours a day. That's a long story, but, I mean, he was saying the same thing that, because I talked to him before ISIS came on the scene. He's like, ISIS is just there to sort of shift the linear dichotomy and go, well, this is the most extreme, so it makes the other groups seem more legitimate. But al-Nusra is the big enemy right now, and that's the one with the deepest ties to the Israelis. And, of course, the press is not going to say anything against Israel. Like, when they just had the ceasefire, yeah, the Americans broke the ceasefire, and it's almost like a coordinated attack. Like, here come the Air Force, and then the Al-Qaeda ground force follows up and takes ground. But prior to that, the Israelis, who were not even part of the ceasefire, went in and bombed the Syrian army and didn't hit any terrorists. They went right after the Syrian army. They've exclusively attacked the Syrians, and yet they just get along with these groups, these terrorist groups. But it's a terrorist state itself.
Absolutely.
But, you know, if we – Electric Intifada, I mean, that is shocking to me, because they're clearly for Palestinian rights, and you know, why would they swallow this narrative on Syria? I guess part of it could be that just the rebels are always right and the government is the big bad guy, and just sort of fits the worldview. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think there's, I mean, there's certainly a segment of the anti-Syria, you know, population, like Westerners, that actually still believe there's a revolution. It's mind-boggling. They still believe it now that there's a revolution that ever was. Some, you know, are on the more, on the Kurdish side and thinking that the Kurds have created a paradise in Rojava or wherever that place is, and others are still maintaining, yeah, well, there was some violence, but it wasn't from our rebels. It was from others, you know. So,
well, the Kurds are being used, and actually, the talk that Maram and I gave in Australia, I should have that footage today. We broke that down into all the different Kurdish factions, and you know, they're just being used as cannon fodder, and they'll get double crossed once they're, you know, done to using them. It's something else, but you know, you have energy politics and all these different things going on at once, but ultimately the Israelis wrote the script for the war in Iraq and Syria before either one happened. So you can pile on all these ads, additives of, you know, pipeline interests and other things that, you know, overlapping, because it's not like there's just a reason for the Syrian war. There are multiple reasons for any war, but the main thing is the West, with the Israelis in particular, wrote the script of what they wanted and why. This is to weaken Hezbollah and, you know, cut the belt between Iran and Lebanon. And Lebanon is supposed to be next, but it looks like with Aleppo being freed, it's not going to happen. So it's on to Raqqa now. You know, and I really want to thank you for your hard work and your journalism. And if you have a Patreon or something, I'd love to link to it, because, folks, she's not getting paid by Vladimir Putin, or she's not FSB. These are some of these people are my friends. We're just regular journalists, and we take donations. And, you know, getting paid far less than people who just write smear campaigns and are helping, basically abetting crimes of children getting killed. That's what they're really doing. And they get paid to attack people, who on their own money, on their own dime, from their own empathy, go to Gaza, go to Syria, talk to people, get the witness testimony, only to have it undermined by one guy in the UK who calls himself an observatory. It's really ridiculous.
Thank you. Yeah.
Do you have a place where people can donate, or like a, if you don't have Patreon, I would suggest starting that up.
What is that?
Well, Patreon. Okay, this is very important then. That's how I get paid. It's a place where if you're posting videos or articles, people can pay per article or video, or they can pay a flat amount a month. And I will help you with this, because this, I guarantee this podcast will get a few thousand views. And, you know, people can give a dollar a month, 50 cents a month. You just set it up. I'll help you with this off air. But, okay, thanks. We're going to set you up with that, and I'm going to add it to this podcast on ANC Report. Below, you will see Eva's Patreon. Please get in there and support her.
Thanks so much, Rai. I mean, I started the blog. It's called ingaza.wordpress.com, and I went with that name because I was in Gaza at the time, and it wasn't about me. It was what I was living in, or what I was seeing in Gaza. However,
what motivated you to go to Gaza, for folks to know?
I had gone to the occupied West Bank in occupied Palestine in 2007, and volunteered with the ISM there, the International Solidarity Movement, and was eventually, after 8 months, deported and banned from going back.
Was it the war in 2006 that made you say, "Okay, I'm going to go to the West Bank"? Like,
it was. I've been actually pretty upfront with people that I was completely politically naive and not engaged at all in any sort of way until about 2006, and then I was. I did definitely wake up during the war on Lebanon and on Gaza, but I was also just around that time starting to learn, period, about anything related to Palestine or any of these issues.
Really? So what, do you remember what it was that got, was it just the war? Like, how did you become political?
It, w- It was, I was actually teaching English in South Korea, paying off my debts as we do, university debts. And I had done it for a year, and then I traveled for about 8 months in Southeast Asia, just traveling for the heck of it. And traveling is a great form of education. And I just, when I came back to, you know, after going through, especially Cambodia.
Did you come to Japan, by the way?
No, I've only gone there for visas. I'd like to, but I haven't had the chance to travel there. But when I went back to South Korea...
for visas, let me explain that to people. People in Japan bounce over to South Korea and back and get a visa, and people in South Korea do the same.
Yeah, that's the extent of my travels in Japan. But after after living in a country where I was speaking very simplified English, you know, and like basically... cut off from any news source. Not that I was very political before, but anyway, I just started wanting to know more about what was happening in the world. So I started looking at online media, and it was the first time also that I actually had an internet connection. You know, this was back in 2004 or so. And so I had internet in my apartment, and I used to listen to online media as I did stuff in the apartment. And it was the first time that I actually consciously heard of Palestine. So it was like a slap in the face suddenly hearing about all the things that were happening in Palestine. And it, I think because I didn't know anything before, it had a big impact and made me want to learn more and then made me want to go there. And then it's just been a, you know, ongoing learning curve since then.
Wow. I mean, that is something else. I mean, you heard, you finally got online media and got so moved by it. You're like, okay, I'll go over there. I mean, I remember getting a letter from Rachel Corey's parents. I was the head of a Palestinian organization at my college at the time. And I felt so helpless because they were reaching out to what few Palestinian organizations existed back then. And I'm thinking, gosh, we only have like 18 people. Like, we're not, we're bigger than the Syrian Human Rights Observatory. But like, I didn't know what to do, but that is something else. So, yeah, so that's why your blog is Gaza, because that's where you ended up at the time. And then,
that's right, yeah, but now it kind of makes more sense to change the name of the blog. I'll probably just change it to my own name, you know, for the sake of ease. So right now it is ingaza.wordpress.com. There is a PayPal thing, but I'm interested to learn more about this Patreon that you were talking about.
Patreon is better. A lot of people hate PayPal, for I'm sure you've had headaches with them.
Yes.
People can use PayPal on Patreon if they want. They can use credit card. They can use whatever, but... yeah, you don't get taxed as much. It's just better because, like, with PayPal, because I lost my PayPal account just for having the word Syria in it.
Yeah, I can believe that.
they took it and they're like, well, we can't have anything with Cuba, Syria. They sort of list all the places. And I'm like, well, I'm not sending money to Syria. I was helping someone from the Syrian diaspora, it doesn't matter, but, you know, I wasn't doing anything illegal. And that they were so scared. I'm like, you're giving hundreds of millions of dollars to these rebel groups, and you know, I'm somebody in Japan. It was something else. So Patreon is far better, and I hope to set you up with that today and get you followers. And I hope some of my followers will donate to you as well and get you up as fast as possible. That seems to be where you know, real grassroots media is going, because for me, if you've been following me, you know, I make a lot of YouTube videos, and I just say, look, this takes a lot of time and research, and a dollar a month is not a big deal. It's like less than a cup of coffee for most people, and they won't even remember it, but that adds up for us, you know.
Yeah.
It's a huge stress relief to get that monkey off your back where, you know, you're working outside, you know, doing your, like, this could possibly finance your trips and everything. You can set goals, so... This
yeah, there was actually, when I was in Lebanon, I was in Syria this summer, and then I was waiting in Lebanon and living in the cheapest environment I could possibly live in outside of Beirut in this decrepit old hotel, which charged me only $10 a day, but, you know, I was hand washing my clothing, et cetera, very, you know, simple existence. And one day I realized I only have $5. I've got to do something. It was crazy. I mean, I can't let myself get into those situations, but literally a lot of us who go to Syria who don't have full-time jobs because we're dedicating our time to researching and sharing truth do get in some pretty tight situations.
Well, your career path's kind of cut short, because just by, like, for myself, covering Israel, you know, anything forget it. I mean, you Google my name and I'm like a friends with hate criminals and Holocaust denier and whatever other crap they're going to say. I don't think I could get hired in the United States because you can't really defend yourself when they gang up on you like that and take over the search engines. And so all of us have sacrificed a lot. We've, you know, all of us have had periods where we're living on ramen or whatever. And, you know, but I started this 20 years ago. There was no Facebook. There was no MySpace. There was no YouTube. It was, this, you know, it was like AOL Hometown and things like that. So it has been uphill, but things have been getting better and the media has been getting better. Our reach has been getting bigger. I think a lot of people are turning off the corporate news networks. They're listening to podcasts like this, like Scott Horton on Anti-War Radio, things like that. That's what they're gravitating to because we're telling them the truth. And anybody with prudence will say, well, they got it right on Iraq. They got it right on Libya. There must, you know, let's listen to these people on Syria. So, yeah, I really hope people get into your Patreon. And let's set that up. And I'll let you go, but stay on the line. I'm going to end the recording, but I want to help you with that right now. All right?
Okay. Thanks so much, Ryan. It's great to have this chance to have spoken with you. Such an informed person about Syria. It's actually very, very nice.
Hey, thanks for following me. I'm glad you found me. I'm curious, what was it? How did you first see any of my stuff?
I believe it was a year or so ago, it was an interview that you'd done with James Corbett, I believe.
Okay. Another expat in Japan.
Yeah, and I have a lot of respect for his work as well. So, I think it was more than one because I know you've done a lot of interviews with him or he with you.
I don't know. We both used. I used to work for Sabelle too, where he works now, and I was her first employee, I think. And yeah, he's been on my show. I've been on his show. I don't know. 5 times each or something. So I don't know. A lot.
Yeah.
So he used to have other things before his report. So yeah, good guy. Okay. Well, let me let you go. Thank you so much for your time. Continue your work and let's set up your Patreon and folks, let's get down below and give Eva your shekels. All right.
Thank you.